So I'd like to talk tonight about seeing clearly and seeing through. In a sense, this title captures really the whole thrust of this exploration. Seeing clearly and seeing through. I'd like to talk about that. What we're doing here is exploring the possibility of a direct, exact, and final discovery of the structure of reality and the ultimate nature of being. And this discovery can be used or described in different ways, but one way to describe it is remembrance. This body-mind process that's sitting here is the vehicle, it is the gate for this discovery. People contemplate and talk about, you know, the purpose of life and the purpose of the body and give different kinds of, you could say, explanations for that. I would put before us the purpose, if there's a purpose, or the function, the possibility, is that this body-mind process is the vehicle. It is the Dharmakaya. It is that which allows the awakening. Buddha is not a title per se. It's simply a statement of fact. It is the fact of being awake. And so what do our minds come up with around this awake word? Or being awake? In our common language, we say, I woke up at 6 o'clock. I was not quite awake yet, although I got up. I was very drowsy. I didn't get enough sleep. I had a kind of awakening when I looked at a bolt of lightning. And on we go, using the word I and awake in the same sentence. Have you ever considered the possibility that you're closer to being truly awake when you're sound asleep than when you're in the conscious states? Why is that the case? Because the I is gone in deep sleep. The story of me is gone. The issue with money. The issue with your relations. I have a very bossy, in my opinion. Every now and then in these Dharma talks, you can share an opinion. Here's one. I have a very bossy sister. She would not agree. See, that's the problem with opinions, because you go in one direction with your opinion and there's going to be something else. But she tends to, we don't interact a lot, but when she does interact with me, if she's got something on her mind that she needs and it's related to something, say, in the family, she just comes right out with it. And it's generally pretty charged. This is the way it needs to be. I'm going to get back to that, okay? Just hold on there, that one. Just let that one sit. Ease back in. They always told me when I was young, careful when you go to other people's houses. There's two things you can't talk about. You know what I'm talking about, right? Religion and politics. And I don't know about you, but as soon as I heard that, I immediately wanted to learn more so I could try it. Carefully. There's certain things that come through your family tree that you want to kind of get a handle on, otherwise they could handle you. Bob Dylan, great poet, musician, still around. I was thinking about him at dinner. He said, in order to live outside the law, you got to be honest. That's the outlaw, isn't it? As far as I'm concerned, Christ was an outlaw. The Buddha was an outlaw. Mahatma Gandhi's an outlaw. Martin Luther King, outlaw. Outlaws in this room? I'm thinking about Coleman Barks. Coleman Barks, you know Coleman Barks? He reads Rumi poems really well. Coleman Barks will say sometimes, in order to read Rumi properly, I have to die. I have to die. I watched a Dharma talk once, this German monk. Well, he was out of the robes at that point. His name was Vimalo. I don't know whether he's still around. Really interesting guy. 25 years as a monk in Thailand. Hardcore concentration practice. 25 years of this. That's a chunk of time. And he's riding in a cab in Bangkok, back seat. And all of a sudden it hits him like a bolt of lightning. All that practice, 25 years, did nothing. And he's roaring with laughter. You could think, I could think, oh, he needed those 25 years to warm up, to see that it did nothing. When I caught up with him years later, he started out a Dharma talk, and it really was going a little flat. And I think a lot of us could feel it. Like he wasn't dying. Just, it was not opening up. Or you could say living. And so he just quit in the middle. He said, this isn't working, I'm stopping. And everybody was like, because, you know, sometimes these things, not hopefully not so much here, they can start to look kind of official. You know what I mean? This semi-podium thing. You know, this light that I'm hoping doesn't get in your eyes. You got the spotlight on you. I didn't want to turn the lights up because I watched you look up and it was like... So anyways, I catch up with this Vimalo and, you know, talk's not working, and so he just says, okay, I'm quitting, I stop. I think, well, what's going to happen next? And he just flipped it and he said, just ask questions. Boom. It's wonderful. You know, sometimes you like somebody... I mean, just sometimes you really like them. Like I have this thing that I've done from childhood. When I really like somebody, I do a sort of a clandestine, in disguise stalking. Don't worry, it's gone. At this point, it's eradicated. I worked it out. But I used to like do that. You know, like I had a friend. I used to kind of go by his house, and I knew he had a girlfriend. So I felt like you can't get too close here. You know, just. You know, not by just take a peek, you know. He's very spiritual, you know. He really had it together, in my opinion. You know, I'll get back to him in a minute. I'm building up footnotes. Okay. So, one thing about the practice, too, is that if you go along a ways, you know, you tend to really forget things. It's not because you're developing Alzheimer's, but what happens is you really... don't remember unimportant things. Because this opening, this third noble truth of the Buddha, this cessation, it really is, it's forms of death. It's forms of falling away. So the Buddha is not a title. And it's not a concept. Although it's a word, What it's pointing at is the nature of being awake. And here again, Ananda is attendant, so devoted. Although he served the Buddha for 20 years, right at his side, helping him with everything, Ananda was unable to perceive more than the Buddha's outer appearance and form. Which means he was caught in the appearance. Just like little Paul, trying to get really close to somebody. Now you could guess inside that, well, there's that pull of the truth, there's that devotion. Maybe that's hiding inside, underneath the appearance. Because if I think I'm somebody, and then I think somebody else has something that I don't have, and then I need to feel closer to that being, am I in an appearance or the truth? Does anybody in this room have anything that anybody else doesn't have? So if this works for you, could we consider the historical Buddha as a living human expression of this ultimate nature that we all are? And through an embodied expression, a tangible body embodied expression, bringing the teachings forth that are educative, a root of education, educari, means to draw out the truth. That's what education is really supposed to be in its root definition. This education or educative possibility is not indoctrinating. The Dharma is not a doctrine. It's not a dogma. It's not a set of beliefs or opinions. It's the truth. And it's specific, very specific in its capacity to decondition misunderstanding and delusion. That's its potential, and in fact, that's its promise. That's why it's on the planet for us. Now, if you consider this, there's many forms of learning and education going on. And some of us are very involved in different kinds of learning and education. And they're wonderful. However, they often condition the mind further, and sometimes very subtly, they condition the mind further in the sense that they're not primarily aimed at truly liberating us. But rather, instead, they're about providing information, tools, and means to get around better within samsara. Like apps. They're cool. They're interesting. People are making them up tonight. And then somebody's making an app off of somebody else's app. And they're very interesting gifts, in a way. And a lot of them, as you know, are free. But what they do, generally speaking, unless you see beneath the appearance, is they give you a little bit of a sense, if you're attracted to it and you use it, to navigate samsara a little bit better. I have a 25-year-old daughter who needs a new car. Now, this is based on the fact that her car is kind of old, but it still runs good, and it's a Toyota, which could go a lot longer, in my opinion. Paint's a little thinned out. She's beat up a little bit of it here and there, hit a pole. You know, it's a little bruised. But the issue that means the new car is needed is the airbag light has gone off. The airbag light has gone off. And the people that she's talked to said, your airbag may or may not work. So now the texts are flowing in. She doesn't live in this state. The texts are flowing in about how can I be driving around in a car with an airbag light on? They said it may or may not work. It's kind of on the edge. This is a place where I find myself way too often. On the edge. The edge between philosophy and psychology. The edge between psychology and body therapy. The edge between you and me. The edge between the Dharma and psychology. The edge between living and dying. Ever feel like you've been close to death? Ever had a near-death experience? Rounding out the family tree, I have an equally interesting but different brother. When we were young, we used to ride motorcycles, he faster than me, and he more recklessly than me. And once I made the stupid move to get on the back with him. I love my brother. You'll see why. I get on the back with my brother. Not a good thing to do in most cases unless you really trust who's up front. That's just my opinion. My brother's got very long legs and he rides with them out. And this is back in the years of these Kawasaki's that are really fast and loud, back in the 70s. And so I get on the back with him and I'm holding on to his waist and he brings it up to 100 going down the highway. That's just getting opened up. And his knees are out like this, and my hands are around his waist, and I'm starting to feel a little bit nervous. Because he's been known to take really big chances. Now I'm on the back with him, starting to feel to me, you know how you can feel times, people, you can kind of feel where they might be going. You don't even have to touch their waist. You can just feel what they might be heading towards. We're coming down a two-lane highway, and a car pulls out from side road and gets in the left lane, and they're waiting for the traffic to clear through the median strip so they can turn, and they're sitting in the left lane. Now my anxiety is really going up. And he's right on the dotted line. You know how fast they go by at 60, 70, 80, 90, 100? Bike is screaming loud. He's not going to be able to hear me. I can't talk to him. He's down like this with his knees out. All of a sudden, we're in a race. Another car pulls out in the right lane. There's a space. I don't know how big it is. He lines the bike up in the space between the one car and the other car, and he goes flying right through. On the edge. I was a little upset. In fact, there was a sense of violence emerging within me. And I did strike him not too hard on the back as he slowed down. And then I got off and I said, I don't care how far I am from home, I'm walking. Clinical death does not have to happen in order for samsara to drop. Since death is a mystery, and if we're fortunate, we may see it clearly, these little deaths of the waking state into sleep, these little deaths of the in-breath and the out-breath, these little deaths of thoughts coming and going, these little deaths of an emotional upsurge passing away, these little deaths are warm-ups. I was reminded last night during our standing meditation, as we received the lesson in fainting, that I myself felt important to develop a fifth style of practice. The Buddha taught mindfulness lying down, sitting, walking, and standing. Little did I know, see, life catches up with you. Little did I know that when I was a child, I was training in the Dharma in the following way. When I would get sick, and usually it was with a fever, more often than not, during the course of the fever, I would faint. This went on through school, carried right off into high school. In the biology lab, the formaldehyde coming off the frog was enough to send me, and I fainted in the hall. It would always create a scene. It's interesting because people can think you're dead. People can think something serious has happened to you. Maybe it has. But what happened to me, slowly I realized that this fainting was attractive, that I actually liked it. Now, when the meditation came into my life, I realized, slowly but surely, that this fainting that I was, you know, somewhat actually attached to, when I would get scared enough in the meditation, I'd just faint. Now, I usually fainted sitting. My first attempt at this in a serious long-term retreat, I faint, and the attendants pick me up, and they sort of drag me out, and they're walking me around, and they're saying things to me like, you need to walk now. And I'm like a boxer that's been knocked out. Got my hands on their shoulders, and I'm saying, let me back in there. I can keep sitting. They said, no, you need to see the teacher. You can't sit right now. I said, I'm fine. Let me back in there. I can sit. He's babbling. Go to the teacher. He listens to this. He says, don't let that happen. Yes, sir. Lesson didn't get all the way in. Some years back now, a couple years ago, I think it is Steve. Steve suggested I see a teacher, this Tibetan teacher, very lovely teacher, Mingyur Rinpoche, wonderful man. He reminded me of this chick when we started the retreat. I had an incredible, worst case of poison ivy that I ever had in my life. I'm not going to miss this retreat. What's the difference between devotion and insane fascination? Fly up to Minnesota, get to the retreat, everything's going well. The poison ivy's getting worse. I'm like, boy, this, I'm not even near the top of this curve. Meanwhile, the body is going through different degrees of dissolution. Generally, before the mind dissolves, the body starts to really become porous. It's a little scary to some of us. We don't leave the body, you don't have an out-of-the-body experience, but the body becomes porous. It's like there is no inside and outside. So, what happens? I'm sitting in the hall, it's early in the morning, about 300 people in the room, and this dissolution thing's happening. And then, woof, just comes right through, and I faint. And the people in attendance respond differently than we did last night. They call in the paramedics. And we've got a whole crew in there, and I'm being checked out in front of everybody, examined. You know, they're not injecting me with anything, but they're like, and I'm laying there. And here's the piece that I'd really like to say. When a faint occurs, in the East they used to call it swooning. When the faint occurs, boom, the eye's gone. And usually, as the awareness comes back, there's bliss. This is what I got attached to when I was a kid. Not that I wanted fevers so that I could faint, but if I got a fever, I'd figure out how to faint. Not that I was planning it. Fainting. This shift that we're playing with here is nothing short of a radical, fundamental shift in paradigm, shift in view, shift in perspective. It's an unlearning more than a learning. We don't need to learn more about who we are. We need to unlearn who we think we are. Held and even cherished in the conditioned mind, sustained by the energies of fear and desire and delusion, which means not seeing clearly, there's a fundamental, apparent dream split delusion, which gives rise to the sense I am the subject and the world is the objects. This fundamental sense of separation, which not only is the root of all anguish and suffering, but is that which drives all the seeking, the hoping, the longing, and additional dreaming that appears in the mind. When the mind's off in discursive thinking, that's a dream. When the body-mind's absorbed in emotional pain, that's a dream. If you say, okay, is all of this a dream? A lot of people would say, no, the dream happens at night, this is real. That's a dream. It's a dream to believe that you are thinking your way to reality. This dreaming, in all of its forms, interesting forms, I don't know how it is for you, but lately, I actually have much more fun dreaming than being awake. It just turned around. I don't know why. I mean, you weren't in my dream last night. I mean, you. But other interesting people were. And there's always interesting, lately at least, interesting situations, interesting so-called problems. And there's this amazing lucidity that shows up all the time. And I seem to be having the most fun with the most difficult problems. This could all dissolve in a second, but lately this has been sort of the chapter that's been unfolding. It may switch around. Wake up laughing, wake up not even laughing, wake up laughing so hard I'm crying. You've had that? Crying with joy? It's interesting. Am I getting bored with the waking state? Bored with this samsara? Bored with this dream? One of the greatest hypnotherapists of our time, Milton Erickson, very creative man, helped so many people in his life. They asked him once, why are you coming up with all these incredibly inventive, like out-of-the-box ways of helping people? And he said, because if I didn't do that, I'd be bored. This dreaming, this is where the force of becoming, this is where the cycles of experience seem to veer off from the nature of being and appear to suggest that you and I are wandering, lost from home. In some cases, it doesn't hurt that much to be lost, does it? Wandering in the mind or the outer world. By the way, you never get lost in the outer world unless you're lost in your mind first. No big deal. Some people intentionally go out and wander around and get lost. this Mingyur Rinpoche that I mentioned, that Steve suggested I go see. 3-year wandering retreat. He disappeared. His attendant, as far as I know, his attendant went in to give some food or do something. He was gone. I mean, there's people who do 3-year retreats in buildings, right? 3-year retreat, wandering around. Nobody knows where he is. It's towards the end. I think he's coming back soon. Yeah. A lot of people are very interested in that. I'm interested in that. This is lightweight. I mean, it's fun. It's lightweight. It's serious. But, you know, we're just here for 2.5 days. 3 years? Mind says, more is better. Watch out. Less is more. In some cases, this wandering, this lostness, it can get extreme. It can get so extreme, the only thing you are capable of operating, is operating from survival instinct. In terms of doing, part of my work is as a therapist, in terms of doing work with couples sometimes, when it gets really difficult between couples, I've heard it many times over the years, people will report, I am completely in survival mode. Just bearing with it. Thus, the benefit of a relatively safe haven and supportive environment, such as this, so that this looking, this seeing, and this possibility of seeing through has a chance to happen. But let's not make any mistakes about it. This looking, this seeing through can happen at any time, any place. It's equally available and open in McDonald's across the river as it is right here. Let's change gears. How many of you know a little bit of, or maybe a lot of, and maybe like or love the poet Hafiz? Hafiz is, in my view, so spot on. Most of the time he just seems to slightly edge out Rumi. Hafiz's spiritual teacher was an interesting character named Muhammad Atta. Ring a bell? This is a different one. He's a chemist or perfume expert. He owned a shop. He lived a very ordinary public life. This is Muhammad Atta, Hafiz's spiritual teacher. And only a small circle of his students knew him as a spiritual teacher. Interesting, huh? So I don't want to go on too much about this, but the thing I'd like to mention is one day when Hafiz was well over 60 years old, he'd been with his teacher for many years. He confronted his aged teacher and he said, "Look at me. I'm old. My wife and son are long dead. What have I gained by being your obedient disciple for all these years?" After Atta gently replied, "Be patient and one day you will know." Hafiz shouts, "I knew I would get that answer from you." In a fever of spiritual desperation, he began another form of 40-day vigil. This time, he draws a circle on the ground, sits within it for 40 days and nights without leaving for food, drink, or even to relieve himself. On the 40th day, an angel appears to him and asks what he desires. Hafiz discovered during the 40-day vigil that all his desires had disappeared. He replied instantly to the angel, "My only wish is to serve my teacher." Just before dawn, Hafiz came out of the circle and went to his teacher's house. Atta was waiting at the door. They embraced warmly, and Atta gave Hafiz a special cup of aged wine. As they drank together, the intoxicating joy of the wine opened his heart and dissolved every trace of separateness. With a great laugh of delight, Hafiz was forever drowned in the Divine Beloved. Should I ask them to serve wine? Would we be breaking the rules? Probably not. Let's be clear. This radical shift is not dependent on anything specifically because it's outside of causation. The possibility is right here, right now, every moment, each experience, and in no way dependent on formal meditation, silence, decent food. It is not dependent on anything. It's just our mind that says, we need the circumstance, we need the da-da-da-da-da, these props. And yet, silence, stillness, good like-minded company seems to coax the opening, although these things aren't necessary. We begin to see deeply into the truth of things, we see that everything that's happening is coaxing the opening. Life as it is, in every nuance, is coaxing the awakening, coaxing the opening. Because this opening isn't dependent on anything. Collection of the Buddha's teachings after he passed in the Dhammapada, which means at the seat. Pada means seat. Dhamma means truth. Pada, seat. Dhamma. Same as Dharma, just different language. Dhammapada. What we are today comes from our thoughts of yesterday, and our present thoughts build our life of tomorrow. Our life is the creation of our mind. That's the relative life. That's the karmic life. That's the appearance life. Apart from our thoughts, there is no such thing as mind. Therefore, thought is the nature of mind in the same way that sensations are the nature of body. Body-mind is a wonderful set of powers that are residing in the field of awareness. This body-mind that's abiding or residing in the field of awareness is just one expression of being. The first glimpse, many of us have had glimpses, we may not remember them. The first glimpse will often come in childhood. And yet, oftentimes, like the aperture in the camera that pops open, it quickly closes. It took 2 decades after what I'm going to share with you now to realize what had happened. When I was 5 in kindergarten, You may have been in kindergartens too, where they made you take a nap. On this particular day, I had no interest in taking a nap because, in some sense, I was really awake. And I remember distinctly feeling quite resistive to even lying down. And yet, you're in school, and in most school situations, there is a need to conform and to comply. Everybody had to lie down. Isn't that interesting? Lie down, take a nap. Imposing a nap. Not for me. I lie on my right side, which happens to be my favorite side if I'm going to pick one, and I can't close my eyes. They won't close. And I'm staring out these windows, and the sunshine's coming in, and suddenly, simply, gently, everything is complete. It's just wonder, and it's recognized. It's timeless, which means no thought. And then what I'd call the booming voice of the teacher. Time to get up. And her chunky, I remember that, her chunky calf moved by my body as she walked through us. Time to get up. Back to samsara. Gone. 8 years of meditating, sitting around like this, and that comes back up. Holy smokes. You forgot that, huh? So clear. That was before the fainting came on. What we're about is moving from this relatively contracted, limited, alienated, yes, that's a strong word, but it's true, alienated dream of individuality and a self that needs to protect itself, that needs to develop itself, that needs to become itself. It needs to improve itself. That needs to govern itself. That's a big one for me. So when I'm having a hard time governing myself, that's when the edge appears. These things have toned down. I'm pulling some history. We're moving from this contracted, limited, alienated sense of individuality and the story of me into the possibility of an ever-increasing, unbounded openness that, again, Zen Master Dogen called intimacy with all things. The very nature of every sentient being is Buddha, awake, aware. But because we don't recognize this, we circle in samsara. Oh, the Karmapa prayer of the lineage of Bodhisattvas says, may I develop compassion, oh unlimited one, towards all sentient beings. And I suggested today in a small group, compassion isn't a warm feeling. Compassion is the destroyer of ignorance. This Vipassana word, Buddhist Pali word, means, among other things, to see clearly. And of course, if clear seeing is happening, then the possibility of seeing through may happen. Like Steve's instructions this afternoon, seeing clearly no ownership. Where's the owner? Just because your name is on the title doesn't mean there's an owner. It's just how the title paperwork suggests it. As most people tend to say, the bank owns my house anyways, and they don't let you forget it. Seeing clearly what? Seeing through what? Same thing I've been saying. I said this to Steve after the lunch break. I keep saying the same thing in different ways. I can't seem to talk about anything else. Seeing clearly what? Seeing through what? Same answer to both questions. Appearances. Which is experiences. Seeing experiences clearly? Seeing through experiences. What does seeing through experiences mean? As we look into experience, we begin to clearly see that's a thought, that's a sensation, that's a sound, that's a color, that's a smell, that's a taste. It's clear. Distinct. In some cases, it seems like the yellow is illuminated. It's really clear. And there's no apparent more sunshine on it. The dust comes out of the eyes. Appearances, that's what we're seeing into, these appearances, these experiences. And then we begin to see the nature of these experiences, not just that these things are happening, but what's happening to these things as they're happening. See that? What's happening to experience as it's happening. And what's happening to experience as it's happening is the same thing for all experiences. Change. So for now, consider anything that changes as an appearance. That which comes and goes. And again, like I said last night, the only thing that doesn't come and go is nothing. Or, if you like, the only thing that doesn't change is no thing. The expectation, subtle as it may be, to see or to see through, to get to something, or remove something, are the workings of the wandering samsaric mind. So then, what does it mean to just sit and rest? Hopefully we have a little sense of this. If we've had it before, it's deeper. And notice that experiences are just happening spontaneously, and they don't need expectation added to them in order for them to be seen clearly. Actually, there's nothing here to improve. There's nothing here to become. There's nothing here that needs to change, and yet things change. Very important. Nothing needs to change, and yet things change. This is what clear seeing illuminates. It's the shift from seeing to seeing through. It also happens when there's a shift from what is being seen to that which is seen. Notice this right now. Notice that which is seen through the eyes. Not that the eyes are seen, like the Upanishads say, not that the eyes see, but that whereby the eyes can see. What is seen through the eyes that see? And some people place the word presence there. Some people place the word awareness there. Another way to get it, it's like looking at a movie, and instead of being lost in the script and lost in the music and lost in the characters and lost in the story, and forgetting your life story, your sense of self, in that, you're looking at the movie, and quite interestingly, the appearance on the screen dissipates, thins, or dissolves, and you see the screen behind the movie. Or the other way around, as this scene clearly opens into seeing through, that which is seeing pops out of experience. So you could kind of think of that almost like two ways. The way I first described it is, here's the screen, the movie's on the screen, the movie thins out, dissipates, here's your thoughts, here's your feelings, here's your sensations, and boom, there's a space, there's a screen. Or experiences are happening, and quite suddenly, that which is seeing the experiences pops out of the experience. Not separate from the experience, it just distinguishes itself. Like a periscope. Boom. And the scene in no way separates itself from that which is seen. But rather, it's like illumination of light. The nature of light is to illuminate. What can be discovered is that the sorting through the files, the sensations, the emotions, the mind states, the memories, results in some extent of clarification, and it's not pointless, but it's endless. Very compelling, but arduous. It's the world of therapy in many cases, it's the world of self-improvement, it's the world of the secret. Which I'm sad to say is spiritual materialism at best. You're not supposed to get political, but you got to slide it in a little every now and then. Even the monks in Burma really came out at times. If you follow that story, similar to what happened in Vietnam with Thich Nhat Hanh. And it's like, we can't sit back. We're just talking here. We're talking about action. We're talking about coming right out. Attempting to enter the fray, big time fray, life and death, murder, destruction, non-violently. Right action's an interesting thing to consider. What is it when the stakes are really high? So we could go into a lot of therapy, we could go into a lot of views and ideas and practices of self-improvement, self-relaxation, self-refinement, self-alignment, and never stop and go, what self are we working on? And actually, what we end up with if we do that work, which I've done a lot of it, is we end up with an orderly mind, some of the time, that's at times fairly functional, creative, productive. That's about it. It's nice. It's like a nice feng shui room. Did I say that right? Feng shui? If, however, there's a pointing into and opening into that which sees, then the necessary shift in perspective or orientation or view can happen, and a spontaneous loosening of the grip on life appears. If we're looking for change, we can find it over and over and over and over and over in the realm of phenomena and experiences. Just look at it and see. what keeps coming and going. And this tends to allow more space. It brings a sense of aeration or even buoyancy in our life. However, cyclical existence is what's happening. I mentioned this business about centered, like no center. Consider this. If you're working on yourself, your therapy, your life, is about getting centered. Have you ever noticed that the more you focus on getting centered, you will forever be threatened by the sense of uncentered? Not like major threat, but just centered, and then something else comes up, and it feels uncentered, and somehow you got to incorporate. You got to deal with it. Like balance, the idea of balance. Whatever the mind is fixated on and attached to, you're threatened by the opposite. Attached to femininity, threatened by masculinity. Attached to heterosexuality, threatened by homosexuality. Attached to meat, threatened by veggies. Attached to veggies, threatened by carnivores. Attached to youth, threatened by old age. Attached to your hair, threatened by bald. Attached to pleasant, threatened by unpleasant. There are people who attach to pain, threatened by pleasure. And on it goes. Just see it. It's the appearance of duality. And this is all happening in the mind. If we don't see through, we are locked into appearances. One of my favorite quotes ever. It's from the great teacher, one of the first Tibetan lamas to come to America, Kala Rinpoche. Notice how he puts it. He said, "We live in the world of illusion and the appearance of things. There is a reality, and you are that. When you see this, you see that you are nothing. And being nothing, you are everything. That is all." What keeps us from the freedom that's available in this world is trying to have this world in certain ways and not have it in other ways. And as that push-pull, as that struggle, as that preferential bias, prejudice, tendency loosens, and the sense of needing to possess or own loosens, then you have the world and the world has you. And you don't need your name on the title. And this is where sympathetic joy comes from. Sympathetic joy is the joy that arises when other beings have good fortune. As opposed to comparison, which could lead to envy or jealousy, kind of conceit even could come. Notice this. When someone who you know, something good happens for them, or even anybody, somebody that you don't know, how does the mind respond to that? Sympathetic joy is a spontaneous arising of happiness at the good fortune of others, because in that there's a sense of no separateness. What helped you helped me. That which is seeing right now, this gets a little subtle, that which is seeing right now, not the eyes seeing, but that which is seen through the eyes, is nothing. It's not a thing. Anytime anyone looks for the self, the I, or the me, what they find is nothing. Nothing. What they thought or believed was there disappears. But actually, it doesn't disappear because it was never actually there. Something can't disappear if it was never there. What disappears is the concept, the idea. So this is why progressive teachings about all this business are for the mind. Coaxing it along, softening it up. It's like buttering up the mind. Softening it, loosening it, aerating it, massaging it. Words are pointing into this like butter for the mind. And really, all notions of path, duration, direction, destiny, purpose are simply a collection of thoughts. And when there's a seeing into these thoughts, they always show their true nature, which is the same as every phenomena, every experience, which is empty. Empty of solidity. Empty of permanence. Empty of ownership, possessibility. Empty of I. They're simply concepts that arise and pass, and they don't refer to anything objective. And we can get this one, and many of us have from youth when we were taught perhaps the word is not the thing. That's the teaching right there. And even more specific and significant is that which appears to be progressing as it opens up and falls away and reveals silence, stillness, and simply wonder. That was little Paul in kindergarten's experience, simply wonder. And whether this happens, this wonder opens up through experiences of loss, that's a powerful one. Witnessing death, that's a powerful one. Or meditation. It's critical to get comfortable, truly comfortable, with not just gains, but losses. As I mentioned earlier in our weekend, a couple of deaths in the immediate family, the mother-in-law. About 2.5 weeks ago, and my birth dad. End of January. I'll share briefly, I had the great honor to actually sit meditatively with my dad in the last week of his life and nurse him to that peaceful death that he asked for. And he died pretty much sitting up. He was going back a little bit. He had pneumonia. He was 94. And you know the word samadhi? Sometimes means concentration. Well, once he got where he wasn't talking, and, you know, people have different views about this, whether people that are there can still hear. And there's an idea that they can. So he was sitting in this samadhi, basically, unmoving, and the breath is just going up, up, up. It's getting shorter and shorter and shorter, more space between. You can just see the translucency rising up the body. It was amazing. And I've known for many years, he was my first spiritual teacher. A spiritual teacher is someone who, whether they know it or not, helps you see your true nature. And for me, he was that. It took a while into my adulthood to actually realize that, similar to the experience when I was in kindergarten. And to sit with him and watch him give me this final teaching, in the body, that is. I mean, he's still giving me things, but it just comes in different ways. But now, this last teaching in the flesh, so to speak. And to just watch the transmigration of form, to watch the arising and passing, to just simply see the mystery of being in its living and dying nature. That's what the nature of being is, living and dying, living and dying. Absolutely amazing. And what was equally amazing, back to my dear sister, you thought I forgot about it, didn't you? Love her. I love her, and it's a hard love, difficult love. She tried to steal my dad's medication that I was using to help him, lorazepam and morphine. She tried to steal it and use it for herself during the last week. Samsara gets really, really hard for some of us. And even the potent medications that are all around sometimes don't help, or they make it worse. She couldn't settle. The anxiety was so high. She couldn't settle. She couldn't settle. She couldn't be present. She was just crying, and then she was saying, I don't think I can be here, and da 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 da. But she was watching me. And not only did she try to take the medications for herself, but she tried to take over medicating my dad out of schedule, because her anxiety was so high that she tried to medicate my dad inappropriately and corralled one of the hospice nurses to help her. It was quite a scene. Equanimity's handy. It's a handy thing to have, ability to respond, not react. I have a little bit of it. Finally, she popped through, and she came up to me, and she put her hands on my shoulders with tears in her eyes, and she said, if it's possible, will you be with me when I die? I said, of course, if I can. What a gift. What a gift. Who do you want with you? And would you be vulnerable enough to ask for it? My dad asked. He said, don't put me in a nursing home. Don't artificially resuscitate me. Let me die at home. Let me die at peace. And they lined up like dominoes, and I realized I got slotted for the last job, which is to help him die in peace. You get selected sometimes. You don't choose it. You might not want it. You might hate the role. And yet, it happens. And if you're open and you let yourself see the Dharma's teaching, the key, I would say, is to not collapse into assuming that you understand life and death and think you know what it's about or who you are, because what you recognize is that you're simply playing around in appearances, in concepts and ideas, and the total mystery of this situation is obscured. And the mystery isn't a problem to solve, it's a reality to realize. Not with our thinking mind. It's like with our heart, with our being, we recognize and appreciate and recognize and see. It's all mystery. Thoughts are simply appearing. If we look for the thinker, it can never be found. Discovering that there is no thinker is the same as recognizing the nature of seeing. That which is seen through the eyes that see is the same as no thinker. There is no doer, only doings. There is no actor, only actions. There is no witness, only witnessing. We cannot become what we have always been. We can only intuitively awaken to our original nature, previously hidden to us by appearances. Now, you might be thinking at times here that the goal or the job is to remove the appearances. No! The opportunity is to see through the appearances, and then the appearances dissolve. You don't dissolve them, because you're not even there to begin with. This scene that I'm speaking of is the Buddha's eye of wisdom. Bodhidharma. Brought the Dharma from India to China. Yes? First Zen patriarch. Big job, huh? Bringing the teachings from one country to another. No one's done it before, and this being Bodhidharma does it. He's a big player in this game. Watch this one. He said, our real nature is the unbegotten and indestructible womb. And watch this. In response to circumstances, it transforms itself into phenomena. And this is exactly what is going on right here now. The unbegotten, indestructible womb, in response to circumstances, is transforming itself into phenomena. That is what these body-mind processes are. This womb of being is transforming itself into the exact experiences which are occurring precisely and presently so that this womb can be recognized. Womb. W-O-M-B. The womb or space of being. Is imperceptible. Therefore, appearances are needed to reflect it. Phenomena, experiences, are needed to reflect the womb. In the same way that there's actually nothing in the mirror but a reflection, and yet the mirror is needed for you to see your face. Got it? The appearances are the liberation. Reflecting into that which sees, the womb of being, awareness. Can you come up, if there's a reason for experience, if there's a reason for samsara, can you come up with a more profound and appropriate and deeper significance? Again, one of the greatest saints in modern India, Ramana Maharshi. Watch how he puts it. we think there is something hiding reality, and that it must be destroyed before the truth can be gained. This is clearly ridiculous. A day will dawn when you will laugh at your past efforts, like Vimalo in the taxi in Bangkok. What you realize on that day you laugh is also here and now. In due course, we will know that our glory lies where we cease to exist. Of course, we could play with the word we there, right? What it points at. When the Buddha talked about birth, the ending of suffering means the end of the cycle of birth and becoming. He was not talking about the birth of the body. He was talking about the birth of the I concept. And maybe dogs and cats and chickens and birds are already enlightened, but I'm not sure they realize it. And therefore, we perhaps have a unique opportunity as human beings, the teachings suggest, to actually recognize the original true Buddha nature that we are. This very thin sphere that we live in, so to speak, where if you change the conditions too much in one direction or another, a lot of things start to rock and roll. Those scientists among us know much more than I do about this thin layer we live in. In due course, we will know that our glory lies where we cease to exist. If we truly investigate anything, we'll come to see not only that nothing lasts, but even more, nothing actually exists as we thought it did. Nothing doesn't change, which is the same as everything changes. And one more, I seem to be drawing a lot from the Zen. This is Wu Men, 13th century Zen master. Again, right to the point. Watch how he puts it. It's the whole talk. One instant is eternity. Eternity is now. When you see through this instant, you see through the one who sees. Got it? Captures the whole thing. In summary, samsara, appearance, phenomena, is what reflects the nature of being, that which sees. So that it can be recognized. Puts a little twist on the difficulties, doesn't it? Puts a little twist on the so-called suffering and unsatisfactoriness, doesn't it? We'll close with Hafiz. This poem is called "You Don't Have to Act Crazy Anymore." You don't have to act crazy anymore. We all know you were good at it. Now retire, my dear, from all that hard work you do of bringing pain to your sweet eyes and heart. Look in a clear mountain mirror. See the beautiful ancient warrior and the divine elements you always carry within, that infused this universe with sacred life so long ago, and now join you eternally with all existence. That's the whole talk. Can we sit for a minute or two?